This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Excited today to be joined by a very special guest, a really, really bright person, Eric Harrigan, who is currently Deputy Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services. He's going to talk about sort of what's going on today, some of the priorities, what he's done in the office, and more. Really excited to talk to Eric today. Eric, can you take a moment and introduce yourself, and we'll talk about some of your biggest priorities now and what's going on.
Sure. This is Eric Harrigan. I was raised in Illinois. I lived in Chicago for probably nearly 25 years, on and off in between tours of duty in Washington. And I am the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services here in Washington, D.C.
Now, you're living in a crazily busy time, right in the midst of the sort of growth of the coronavirus sort of stress and situation in the U.S. Before we get into some of that and how it impacts priorities and so forth, just tell us, how did you end up in the Department of Health and Human Services and doing what you're doing? You had a magnificent reputation as a practicing lawyer at large firms, just a great reputation. I'd met you years ago, just a pleasure to deal with. How did you end up in this situation, in this role, in helping to run the Department of Health and Human Services?
Well, I was a partner at Winston and Strawn in the early 2000s there in Chicago. And I ended up interviewing for the Department of Health and Human Services back then in 03. And so I joined the department. I joined HHS under the George W. Bush administration as a deputy general counsel for then General Counsel Alex Azar, who is now the Secretary of HHS. Then was principal associate deputy secretary, which is kind of the more or less the chief of staff or the principal deputy to the deputy secretary. And then finally, I was the acting deputy secretary when then deputy secretary Alex Azar left the department. So I went back to Chicago and went back into private law practice. And then in 2016, I worked in the incoming Trump administration's transition team. Then I got nominated to my current position as the nominated deputy secretary for HHS in March of 2017, and then joined the department, got confirmed by the Senate in early October of that year, and actually just immediately served as acting secretary for 4 months. And so as deputy secretary, that's how I kind of got here. I was here before, actually in the same job, I'm actually in the same chair right now, in the same office that I was in the Bush administration, and which is, it really gives you kind of a perspective on the department, how it's changed between administrations, and kind of a long-term perspective, I hope, that's helpful to HHS now and to the administration.
Fascinating. And what is Secretary Azar like? Because you've worked with him now twice, so you guys must have a very nice relationship. Talk just a moment about, what can you tell us about him?
Well, he is an extremely talented, intelligent person, a great pleasure to work with somebody who really knows the department inside and out and really sort of is dedicated to the mission here. You know, it's, you know, overall, it's the health and well-being of the American people, but he has brought a level of sort of talent, intelligence, and knowledge base to this job. And of course, he had been general counsel and deputy secretary before, and now is the secretary, and in between served and worked in Eli Lilly in Indianapolis. So he has a wealth of information. And we've worked together on and off for, you know, two tours of duty here before. So it's a pleasure and an honor really to serve with him again. And, you know, in my role now, I serve as sort of the chief operating officer, because he is the chief operating officer of HHS. So I coordinate the daily operations, and I oversee HHS regulations, significant guidances in the department, including, you know, CMS and FDA, and kind of just the overall how, making sure the department is running and everything's kind of getting done here.
I had sent you questions a couple weeks ago, and they were talking today. And in that 2 weeks, a ton has happened. And one of the starting questions I had for you is, what's sort of the most interesting things that you work on, that you see in your role, you know, biggest priorities? And can you talk to us about that a little bit And I know that's, you know, obviously in a bit of flux right now, but tell us, what are the biggest priorities, what's most interesting to you?
Right. So, you know, what's top of mind right now for me and really everybody in the department and indeed in the White House and the administration broadly is protecting the health and safety of Americans as we combat the outbreak of the COVID-19 coronavirus. As you may know, this will probably be something that gets dated. The last reported numbers, you know, nearly 5,000 confirmed or presumptive U.S.-based cases. So what we've looked at here is that we're looking at what we expected to see and what we said from the beginning, that there are additional cases in the United States. And with, you know, community spread of this virus in a number of countries, you know, we have, you know, had to adopt a lot of measures that are, they're old measures in some ways, and they're very new issues like quarantine and travel bans that have, you know, come to the fore in terms of aggressive and in many cases very early response to this outbreak globally. So these travel restrictions and the screening that we've implemented were, you know, a large part of how we're trying to help buy time for further preparations here at home, because, you know, people are dealing with something that is in most of our lives unprecedented. You know, you can read stories of sort of older generation, I've read them, people alive today who are dealing with the 1957 flu outbreak or the 1968 one. But this is really unprecedented for a lot of Americans alive today. And so that's really top of mind for us right now.
And does that really move for the moment? I mean, it seems to have moved all of American business off of their core of what they do to sort of almost a hunker down mode for 4 to 6 weeks, with the hope that it crests in 4 to 6 weeks and starts to move back to normal. And I won't ask you for any predictions on timeline or anything of that sort. But is that sort of what happens at the department, the White House? Well, you've got to launch a lot of other priorities. You really end up for some period of time right now, the highest priority becomes this.
Yes. You know, we have to operationalize what is really a whole of government public health response. And, you know, our public health professionals here at HHS and obviously a lot of private sector health professionals are doing a lot of this important work, identifying, diagnosing, isolating, treating, contact tracing people who get exposed to the virus. And it involves a lot of different elements, things from like securing funding from Congress, for which we thank them, to help cover therapeutics, vaccines, personal protective equipment, which is a high item on many people's minds right now, state and local support, surveillance, all kinds of things, and getting things like clinical trials started for therapeutics and vaccines, which we have launched already here in the United States and globally, and securing lots and lots of sort of supplies for us, for our state partners, and also kind of ramping up our efforts to provide more and more, as I say, innovative treatments for addressing the disease, hopefully.
And you see both here that there's already a vaccine that they're starting to test, and I think Washington State today or the last couple of days. I know that in other countries are already starting to try different drug protocols to help contain this and fight this. And so the hope is that kind of work will lead to this being not as much of a long-term travesty as it could be. And certainly the country recovered well from the 57 flu, the 68 flu. The 57 flu hit a insane amount of deaths. The swine flu, ultimately not so many. But hopefully, to put this in context, it ends up being something that we recover from in not too long and very well. Let me ask you a different question about personnel and people. As people watch, I think, I know you, and you might not remember me, but I remember you being a very bright, very good, very centered person. And it seems like the CDC has a lot of those people. And I know that's not for you to comment on, but I take it that in your perspective, when you look at the Department of Health and Human Services, you look at the agencies that you're working with, a lot of serious professionals trying hard to do the right thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you look at, and besides, I mean, you look at the department, we have everything from the CDC, which is really leading the public health response. You know, it has surveillance, state and local, a lot of the state and local connections, a lot of the educative function and keeping track of what exactly is going on with the disease and providing guidance on it. FDA, which works with sort of industry, private sector partners and government to help facilitate the development of new products from the private sector and otherwise. NIH, which, you know, as you said, just this week, they started phase one clinical trial on that COVID-19 vaccine at Kaiser Permanente Health Research Institute in Seattle. So they're working on the development of the vaccine. And then we have all the array of others of our agencies that are also working on this, in addition to working with the other departments on this, because it does require everyone. When you look at our interactions with other countries, might be our Office of Global Affairs here at HHS, but really State Department is the one that is doing a lot of the official outreach to and coordinating that with our global actors. You look at, you know, Department of Defense, which has worked really well with us and in terms of providing us with access to bases and working with us on a number of types of responses. So it really goes across the spectrum, and I'm trying not to leave anybody out here, you know, but we worked really strongly with them in the states. I've been in contact with the states, mayors, the county officials, many of these places that are affected, to work with them as well.
And really everybody trying to figure it out as quickly and as well as possible. I spoke to in our state, sort of in the governor's office today, where they're trying to figure out certain issues. And you sort of almost don't even appreciate the level of micro and macro issues that government is dealing with at the federal, state, and local level. Just so many different issues, so many different pieces, and trying to make sure there's not unintended consequences of actions as well. But it's really, you know, it's fascinating to sort of see the agencies, you know, in our crazily politicized world, try and put aside politics and push forward as much as they possibly can. I mean,
and you know what? I've been very gratified. You can see things on Twitter or announcements or things like that. But, you know, honestly, I have been heartened in at least my part of this job so far, that we've had such good interactions in a bipartisan way from local officials, you know, the governors, the mayors, city councils, by and large, with the response. And that, you know, in many ways, that is because we have, and I think it's because we've spent 15 years across administrations working on preparedness. There have been a lot of money spent over the last 15 years on hospital preparedness and state and local preparedness. And I think there is an infrastructure there that if we did not have it, the response would have been would not have been as strong as it has been in terms of coordination, because people knew who they needed to talk to in many or most cases, and that there were already, you know, exercises done with response to infectious disease outbreaks and things like that had been done over the last decade and a half at least for people to kind of coordinate on that. There's always particularities that we're dealing with now that have to be addressed with regard to the actual situation we're in, but I would say, I think that we are lucky as a country that we have spent a lot of time and effort in trying to get these things done and worked on ahead of time.
A different question. You and Secretary Azar have probably been the most active and proactive in terms of new initiatives of anybody in your role in several years that I recall, in a long time. And that's not a negative on anybody else, but you guys have been very proactive. Talk about some of, you know, taking coronavirus aside, which will take up all the national attention for some time right now. Talk about just briefly a few of the other priorities that you guys had been proactively, or your team had been proactively leading.
Yeah, well, so, you know, in addition to our response to coronavirus, you know, we have other projects that also need to get done for the American people while we're working on the coronavirus response. It is a big department, the largest one in the federal government. But one big project that still needs our attention that, you know, I'm working on is a regulatory reform program that we've called the Regulatory Sprint Coordinated Care. This is a program where we're examining four sets of regulations, the relating to four separate statutes, the anti-kickback statute, Stark Law, HIPAA, and 42 CFR Part 2. And, you know, that's, we call it the regulatory sprint to coordinate care, but each of those words is chosen for a reason. It's regulatory, it's not a legislative program. We're dealing with the laws as they are. It's a sprint. We're gathering the information and moving forward on reform as quickly as we can. And these are all oriented around coordination of care. They're about regulations. Are they impeding coordination among providers? Can we deliver better, lower cost patient care? By opening some of these regulations up and trying to figure out how we can reform them consistent with those principles. It's not a wholesale reform these statutes and regulations, you know, in anything anyone has ever thought of, but really dealing with coordination of care. And I'm sure you know, two of those regulations deal with kind of partnerships and affiliations broadly, Stark Law and the anti-kickback statute. And those we're trying to enable providers to kind of create value, to form partnerships and affiliations amongst themselves. You know, we always ask them to do value-based care. We always ask them to coordinate care. But in many cases, the laws we have on the books, the regulations at least, may lead to criminal violations and huge fines, sometimes institution-ending levels of fines. And so we ask them to do this on the one hand, and we investigate them, maybe jail them and fine them. In many cases, if they do what we have been asking them to do thematically. So we want to figure out, how can we look at these laws and the regulations that have implemented them and try to reform them in the spirit of what we've been saying we wanted?
But the great challenge is, of course, to do so and to allow sort of things like risk sharing, value-based care, almost like, you know, Medicare Advantage, but in the Medicare world, but without necessarily Medicare Advantage, and allow the sharing risk, the sharing of incentives and so forth, but not opening the door to wholesale abuse again that you used to see a long time ago through the health systems paying doctors for referrals or companies paying doctors for referrals. So how do you balance the need for this coordinated care and allowing incentives and payments and risk sharing and so forth without opening the door to the improper behavior that those laws were intended to police?
Yeah, and you know, there, I would say that our staff here, which was really ready to do this, kind of took the ball and ran with it. When we started talking about moving to this, they sat down and thought really hard about it, about how to do this. And they really made it almost a conceptual sea change at how they're approaching these laws, consistent with the law's intent and consistent with the language that's there, but looking at it from a wholly different way to try to allow there to be better coordinated care, which we hear all the time, is what these laws are preventing. And, you know, we're trying to move into a new world. I mean, as you pointed out, Medicare Advantage, that's a classic example of a value-based care system. We got about, I think, 40% of seniors, and a lot higher percentage of younger seniors as opposed to older seniors are in that system. And, you know, not only are we talking about moving that way with regard, you know, as fee-for-service kind of shifts to that in the Medicare world, you know, you look at the anti-kickback statute, that really applies to the entirety of the healthcare space. You know, the Inspector General doesn't say we're just dealing with Medicare, but we're dealing with any potential payer possible in that system because, you know, they're concerned about how a particular arrangement might affect Medicare and other federal programs. So, you know, you're looking at something that we're hoping is kind of a larger impact than just dealing with Medicare in this space. So, yeah, that's the hope there.
Yeah, 100%. So talk, Deputy Secretary, about the two other priorities that you were going to mention, and then we'd love to have you back on to talk further about some of these priorities and about the coronavirus updates in not too long.
Sure, and I'd be happy to. So the other two laws there are really HIPAA and 42 CFR Part 2. Those are information sharing, which are also crucial to coordination. So, you know, they're also kind of moving forward on that. We put out proposed rules for three of those for Part 2, Stark Law, and anti-kickback statute. We're analyzing comments and finalizing language for them. And then stay tuned in the near future, the next few months, for updates on the HIPAA reform. And, you know, besides that, the regulatory sprint, we've got other things. As you point out, we've been very active. You just last week we announced the Office of the National Coordinator of Health IT, their interoperability rule, and the supplemental CMS interoperability rule. That was last week. That may seem a little nerdy, but we believe that that is going to open up an entire, we're talking about their secure standards-based application programming interfaces. That is a mouthful, but we think that having the sort of standard set for people to in the app economy, to move forward to provide Americans really with a longitudinal single healthcare record that's on their smartphone on an app for free is going to revolutionize digital health. It's going to revolutionize all of healthcare. It's something that we think with, you know, over the period of us kind of leaning into this, over a period of time phasing this in, we're going to result in something that's going to really be a huge change in U.S. healthcare. And we have other things as well. The Quality Roadmap Initiative, we're working with the Department of Defense and the Department of Veterans Affairs to align the quality systems across the federal government, and then looking internally at the agencies that administer quality metrics, which we curate essentially 2,000 plus quality measures at HHS alone. Multiply that out of private industry, we have a system that has really got a dizzying array of quality measures that we have heard a lot of outcry on from stakeholders about how it's affecting their ability to provide care, how it's draining the system. And so we're working with internal agencies like CMS, CDC, Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, ARC, Indian Health Service, and HRSA, that's the Health Resources and Services Administration. They all have weighed in on that. So it's really interagency process here at HHS, and then across DOD and the VA. We're trying to create a federal framework, really, for roadmaps for how we're going to move forward on this, because that's been a big issue that we've heard a lot out. It sounds, again, these are in the weeds, but we think they're going to have really big payoffs for getting the reform right in both of these areas, health IT as well as quality.
Well, and so important to both areas that ultimately, even though it's a complicated in the weeds framework, that it gets simplified so IT is easier to share, not harder to share, and there's not blocks to it. Then on the quality side too, that it gets easier and clearer to measure without putting so much burden on, but becomes easier and easier and clearer to report, measure, and what needs to be measured. So fantastic yep. initiatives. For us, I know that your time is busy. You're helping to run the federal government right now with your team and the entire team, and I know coordinating as well as possible and better with the states. So we are so greatly appreciative of your time today, Deputy Secretary Harrigan. Just a pleasure to visit with you. Always great to talk to you, and look forward to having
likewise.
You back on again, hopefully not too long.
Yeah, that'd be great to do. So thanks a lot, and one of the ways to keep in touch with, I always have to put in a plug for our Twitter handle, at DepSec Hargan. That's DepSecHargan.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us, Eric. Just a pleasure as always, and I'm finding it on Twitter right now. Got it.
Yeah.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Matt.